Welcome to Question Period. I'm Evan Solomon. Today on the program, She Too.
If there's an allegation, we'll take it seriously and an inquiry will take its course.
In a shocking twist, the female MP behind some of the biggest sexual misconduct investigations is suddenly being investigated for her own actions against a male military veteran. Does this cast new light on former cases or reveal a deeply troubling culture on Parliament Hill? MPs are here to debate the latest allegations. And then, victims in uniform?
It will ensure victims of service offenses are heard, informed, and protected throughout the process.
Why is it so hard for victims of sexual harassment in the military to find justice? Is the problem finally being fixed? The Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan joins us today on that and on why the former Prime Minister Stephen Harper is wading into Canada's foreign policy on Iran, plus war and peace.
America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail.
After President Trump ditched the nuclear disarmament deal with Iran, has the Middle East moved closer to war, even as peace threatens to break out between North and South Korea? Does Canada have any role in the two biggest crises in the world? Canada's former top spy, Richard Fadden, and retired Major General Dave Fraser give us the straight talk. All that plus Rhonda Ambrose joins us on the Scrum to talk about closing a NAFTA deal. And oh yeah, we'll talk about the upcoming royal wedding because, you know, Harry, Meghan, it's a thing. This is Question Period. Let's go get some answers. Sexual abuse and harassment, misconduct, these are issues that have plagued the military in Canada for years. Even after a former Supreme Court judge concluded that a sexualized culture existed within the military, the numbers remain shocking. Back in 2016, StatsCan reported that close to 1,000 people in the military had reported that they'd been sexually harassed or assaulted within the last 12 months. So the military has tried hard to stamp this out with its Sexual Misconduct Response Center. And finally this week, more reforms, especially the rights of victims. There's now a Victims Bill of Rights for members of the military, meaning like in a civilian court, service people can make a victim impact statement. What other changes have been made? Let's find out. Joining me now, the Minister of Defense, Harjit Sajjan. Minister, great to have you here.
Great, thank you.
What is the key change here? Why did this need to happen?
This allows us to be in line with the Canadian judiciary system to making sure that victims are also going to be looked after, making sure that they go through a process from the time from the making the complaint to the having the assistant to go through the process to be able to do a victim impact statement, which is very important because at the end of the day, we want to encourage people to come forward, but we also want them to know that they're going to be supported all the way through the process.
But this took a long time. This has happened before, where the military says, oh, we're going to stamp this out, and there remains an enormous number of allegations of sexual abuse and sexual assault within the military and a lot of complaints. Mm-hmm. If you and I were sitting here in 1 year, mm-hmm. what's the metric of success?
Well, first of all, for me, the metric of success is making sure that when Canadians join the Canadian Armed Forces, they are going to be in an environment that they feel that they can reach their full potential. That's kind of the wider look.
But in terms of, is there a number you say there's going to be 25% fewer complaints?
So, no, in this case here, for me, the only number is zero, right? But one thing that we want to stress right from the beginning, from the actions that we take, that we have a zero tolerance policy on this, and we will aggressively deal with anybody who actually goes has an infraction in this manner, whether it's minor or serious. We want people who are victims to come forward so they can be investigated and potentially then lead to charges and move forward.
Let me talk about Iran. You commented that when about Stephen Harper signed. Put his name on a full-page ad in the New York Times saying Donald Trump was right to withdraw from the deal to try to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. a position at odds with your government's position. Was it helpful for Stephen Harper to do that, and does he have the right? Is it appropriate for him to do that?
I mean, every citizen has a right to do those things, and Mr. Harper obviously has the right to do so. Is it helpful? No, it's not. And I think somebody of his stature and who's been a prime minister for a very long time, I don't feel that's appropriate, especially when it comes to with NAFTA negotiations going on at the time. There, we are trying to deal with the security incidents around the world. It's not helpful.
What, if it's not helpful though, when should he comment? I'm just trying to, because some prime ministers comment on lots of things. Jean Chrétien has commented on issues. Brian Mulroney has commented. When is it appropriate for a former prime minister to weigh in?
As I said, it's up to them to decide on how they want to weigh in. But given their experience, there are certain ways to weigh in. Buying an ad like that, it's not helpful.
Just talking about Iran, now Iran and Israel are throwing missiles back and forth. Does Canada have any role to play? I mean, Canada once won a Nobel Peace Prize on the Suez Canal in a different part of the Middle East, but we have historically played a role in that region. Does Canada have any role to play as tensions are ratcheting up there?
No, I think Canada is playing a role in the region as part of our Operation Impact. We provided support in Iraq and in the region as well. I mean, we're not directly involved in Syria per se, but in terms of our conversations that we had at our counter-Daesh meetings, we do look at making sure that Iran does not get greater influence in the region to be able to support terrorism. And in this case here, I mean, Israel has every right to be able to defend itself. But we have to be able to, at the end of the day, we're trying to reduce conflict, deal with ISIS, and at the same time trying to bring stability into that region.
One way Canada could have an influence is reopening its embassy in Iran, which your government has talked about. It was closed under Stephen Harper. Is this the time to reopen an embassy in Iran to at least get a Canadian on the ground there?
Well, I mean, this is something for Minister Freeland to obviously, she's has the file on this. For us, when I look at the region, it's about making sure we have a good understanding. And it's only through the proper dialogue you can actually have that tough conversation. And in this case here, we do have very direct conversations with certain nations around
the
world.
Well, an embassy might help you get that intelligence. It might help you get that conversation.
I mean, conversations are always good, but this is when it comes to weighing all the factors. As Minister of Defense, I don't weigh too much into that. I work very closely with Minister Freeland, but has the right experience to in this space, and then she'll go through with the right analysis to figure out the direction that we're going to take.
But you believe that the deal with Iran over their nuclear weapons, you thought that was a good deal that would help bring stability. Getting rid of it, you think?
Well, the JCPOA, it's not it was the ideal deal. However, it was a deal that actually we believe that is actually preventing Iran from becoming a nuclear state. And that's the position that we have taken with our allies, because at the end of the day, we want to be able to reduce the tension in that area.
Does that deal survive without the U.S. in it? Can it?
Well, that remains to be seen, but we'll be working very hard with our allies to make it so.
Last question to you on Mali. There was a big announcement. We're going to send peacekeepers to Mali, the West African country. You had told me when you were sitting mm-hmm. in this chair, we're doing our intelligence gathering. You've been there. The military's been there. Do you have a date yet when Canadian peacekeeper boots will be on the ground?
Like I said, the military has been doing their work. They're doing their reconnaissance. Now they're putting everything together, and I look forward to their briefing, because at the end of the day, I want to make sure I give them the space for them to have the right analysis. Because
but do
it's
they
only
have a timeline?
Well, the timeline will be given once we get the proper analysis to making sure that the assumptions that we had made in terms of what's actually needed on the ground are the things that we can provide. At the end of the day, one thing that I will always commit to, making sure that where we send our troops, they're going to have the right mandate, the right rules of engagement that the Chief of Defense Staff signs off on, and they're going to have the right equipment.
Minister Sajjan, always good to have you in the program. Thanks so much.
Great, thank you for having me.
All right, coming up, Stephen Harper says Donald Trump was smart to ditch the nuclear deal with Iran, as we just spoke about. Justin Trudeau says Donald Trump is wrong. Who is right? The former director of Canada's spy agency ceases, and one of Canada's former top generals weighs in on that subject next. Stay right here with Question Period.
In theory, the so-called Iran deal was supposed to protect the United States and our allies from the lunacy of an Iranian nuclear bomb, a weapon that will only endanger the survival of the Iranian regime. In fact, the deal allowed Iran to continue enriching uranium and, over time, reach the brink of a nuclear breakout.
The situation in the Middle East has been deteriorating since the United States announced it was pulling out of the controversial Iran nuclear deal. Israel has now fired airstrikes at Iranian targets in Syria after they say Iran fired missiles at them. Now Saudi Arabia has said it will launch its own nuclear weapons program if Iran decides to restart there. So it's getting complicated. European leaders, meanwhile, say they're still committed to the deal. They hope Iran is too. Meanwhile, peace is threatening to actually break out on the Korean Peninsula as the first ever meeting between a sitting U.S. president and the leader of North Korea is set to take place on June 12th in Singapore. What can we expect from that summit? Joining me now to sort all this out, the former director of CSIS, Canada's top spy agency, the former national security advisor to both Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Justin Trudeau, Richard Fadden, Dick Fadden's here, and retired Major General Dave Fraser, who commanded the multinational brigade for Regional Command South in Afghanistan. And he just wrote a great book about it. It's called Operation Medusa, The Furious Battle That Saved Afghanistan from the Taliban, which I highly recommend, is also here. Great to see you, General.
It's great to be with you today.
Guys, first, I always thank you both for your service, and congratulations. You're a member of the Officer of the Order of Canada.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Dick. And let me start with you. Donald Trump pulled out of this deal. I'm not sure he's got a plan B. Smart to pull out of the deal?
I don't think so. I think everybody admits the deal wasn't perfect, but it did circumscribe the Iranians' nuclear program. It didn't do it perfectly, but it slowed them down. One of the other objections that people have with this deal is that it didn't deal at all with Iranian terrorist activities, nor with its mucking about in that area generally. But I think it's far better than not having a deal at all. And you were mentioning in your intro that you thought that the Europeans will try and keep it going. I hope they can. I hope we'll support that. But the United States' commercial and trade reach is so great, they're going to have an uphill battle.
Oh, an uphill battle to keep it. Dave Fraser, what's your take on it? Are we safer without the deal or with the deal?
Well, I think we've actually become a little less safe with the United States pulling out of the deal. They say keep your friends close and your enemies closer, and having, you know, a regime like this and talking to them is really important. And also, as Dick said, you know, not a great agreement, but at least it was an agreement where we were talking. We could actually go in there and verify what's going on. But now we've broken that off completely. We've now, you know, emboldened, you know, Israel and now Syria and Iran to start firing missiles at each other. We've now got Saudi Arabia here. We've separated, you know, United States from their traditional allies in Europe. So, I mean, this problem and weak agreement just actually got a lot more complicated.
Well, I understand that. Trump seems to have this idea, and we'll get to North Korea in a second, Dick Fadden, that he can break bad deals and make better deals. So the option for him, he seems to suggest, is it's not like we're going to get no deal with Iran. I'm just going to get a better deal. Is that possible?
I think the chances of that happening are virtually zero. Iran is a significant power in the Middle East. It is an ancient civilization. They're a very proud country. They think they've been mistreated badly by the United States overall. They think Mr. Trump is acting irresponsibly. I think there's not a chance in you know what that they will possibly renegotiate. I think the most we can hope for is they and the Europeans and we will continue. But I think it is generally going to destabilize the whole area because, A, they're taking a whole bunch of oil off the international market. You will have noticed that prices are up already.
Sure.
Saudi Arabia is going to get increasingly concerned. As Dave says, it's mucked up the whole area. Why would they renegotiate when it took months and months of efforts by, you know, the P5 plus one to get this agreement? I don't think there's a hope in hell.
Dave, where are you? Because in the midst of this, things are getting, it's hard to negotiate when for the first time ever, Israel and Iran are fighting each other directly, not through proxies. Now, Iran's a bad actor in all sorts of fashions. But boy, is this heating up towards a potential real war, another war in the Middle East?
Well, it demonstrates the United States, which has traditionally, you know, as you go from one president to the other, there was a continuity of what they said. That's all now broken. So, I mean, Trump has said we're going to break this. There is no new deal. There is no incentive to come to the table to negotiate. And I agree with Dick. I mean, this situation is just absolutely, you know, no one wants to deal with this now. It's actually thrown everything up in the air. Trump as a disruptor has now gone onto the world stage, and his tactics, I don't think, are going to be positive. They're actually going to boomerang back on him.
Yeah, and I don't know what the strategy is, let alone the tactic. Canada, I have very little role in this moment, but Dick Fadden, under Stephen Harper, the embassy closed. Canada had an embassy in Tehran. Justin Trudeau promised to reopen it. In this moment, is this the time that Canada presses forward, knowing that Trudeau supports that deal? Is this the moment that Justin Trudeau tries to get an embassy back open in Tehran?
Well, my understanding is we've been trying to reopen the embassy for some time. I would say this is not a great time to push. For one thing, it will be misinterpreted by the Americans, and we still have a whole range of relationship with the Americans to worry about. But it's also important to remember that to reopen an embassy takes two to tango. When Mr. Harper closed the embassy, he really annoyed the Iranians. I cannot imagine that they're going to welcome us back with an embassy without something in return. So I think he's going to complicate the reopening. So even if we tried, you know, if Ms. Freeland tried tomorrow, next week, next month, I think it would be an uphill battle.
Dave, let me turn to you on North Korea. This meeting's pretty extraordinary. Donald Trump has gone from calling Kim Jong-un Rocket Man, my button's bigger than your button, to why don't we have a summit on June 12th in Singapore? The United States has now offered to economically support North Korea if they give up their nuclear weapons. What is a measure of success for this summit?
Well, I think, you know, we have to look back in history because North Korea has a a good track record in sense of rattling their sabers at the right time. And I recall at the beginning of the second Gulf War how North Korea did this something very similar to ease economic pressures on their internal situation to you know, look good in front of the their own people against the United States and whatnot. And I think what we've seen here is a very skillful move by that regime. And, you know, pulling Trump in to have a discussion, easing economic sanctions, they'll make a promise of doing something. They already have the nuclear capability. They already have the skills to do with this. And I think what, you know, we should look at for success is some sort of indication that they might slow down or stop what they're doing right now. But, you know, at the same time, I don't think we should trust them at all because they have not demonstrated historically an element of trust.
Dick.
I'm not a great supporter of Mr. Trump's approach to foreign policy, but I think in this case, you know, maybe his bullying approach to a bully has got them together to talk. If that has the practical result of slightly lowering pressure on the Korean Peninsula, I think that's great. I mean, the South Koreans have now been talking to the North Koreans, but I'm with Dave entirely. The possibility that the North Koreans will give up their nuclear weapons is as great that I can operate on your brain tomorrow. The leader of North Korea must have in his mind Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein and what happened to them when they didn't have nuclear weapons. It's the only thing, I think, that's preventing a whole raft of possible military activities against North Korea. The event may well cause pressure to be lowered. Maybe there will be a bit of economic this or a bit of strategic that. I don't think there's a possibility that he will abandon his weapons.
Well, I always say, I think we've all learned, let's not tack up the words mission accomplished before the mission is done. Dick Fadden, General Dave Fraser, great to have both of you back on giving perspective on two critical situations. Thanks so much, gents.
A pleasure.
And check out Dave Fraser's new book, Operation Medusa. Coming up, the accuser becomes the accused. Another NDP member faces sexual misconduct allegations. This time, though, there's a twist. MPs are up next to discuss the latest controversy to rock Parliament Hill. Stay right here on Question Period. It was an astonishing revelation from Corporal Glenn Kirkland, a Canadian veteran who was wounded in the war in Afghanistan. He told reporter Neil MacDonald that in 2013, after he gave an emotional testimony at the House of Commons committee about his struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder, that the NDP MP Christine Moore had invited him to her office. He then alleges she gave him drinks, despite his concerns about consuming alcohol while on opioid painkillers and on antidepressants. After that, he says, they ended up back at his hotel room where Moore spent the night. Kirkland did not allege that the encounter was non-consensual, but it didn't stop there. He alleges she kept pursuing him, showing up uninvited at his home in Brandon, Manitoba, sending him explicit messages. He says he decided to finally come forward after she led the charge to have one of her other colleagues, an MP named Aaron Weir, investigated for sexual harassment. You remember Mr. Weir was recently booted from the NDP caucus.
I believe that Ms. Moore used her position of authority very inappropriately. And if the genders were reversed and if I was a female who just did a big emotional testimony, and if a male MP acted the way that she did, I really feel like this would be quite a bit different conversation. And the hypocrisy of this, with her coming forward and being the self-appointed voice of ethics when it came to Mr. Weir's situation, I just find it quite disturbing.
Moore has publicly disputed Kirkland's version of the events, but she's now under investigation for sexual misconduct. She says she welcomes the process, but even though NDP leader Jagmeet Singh stripped Moore of her parliamentary duties, he does not believe these new revelations means he has to revisit his actions towards MP Aaron Weir.
Just because of an allegation that's now risen, which we take seriously, in no way should cast any question of credibility about other allegations.
So, what does all this say about the culture on Parliament Hill? Did Ms. Moore act inappropriately? Is the process fair? Let's find out. I'd like to bring in some MPs. Joining me from Toronto, Liberal MP Pam Dimoff. Also, Lisa Raitt, Conservative Deputy Leader. And here in studio with me in Ottawa is Rachel Blaney, the NDP Deputy Whip. Great to have all of you here,
it's good to be here.
On a Mother's Day. Rachel Blaney, let me start with you. A lot of people are asking, should Jagmeet Singh, in the wake of what happened to Aaron Weir when he kicked him out, does he have to relook at that process now that there's allegations against Christine Moore?
Well, first of all, let's be really clear. These are two very separate allegations. And I have to say that, you know, as you go through this process and with the Me Too movement, we've seen that very clearly, that there's going to be a lot of uncomfortable situations. And how we address those are really important. And so for our leader, the point was to make sure that we had an independent investigation, that the party has that step away from it so that the investigation can happen and the results are impartial and clear. And so that's the process that we're taking.
But the difference here, two things. Your leader said that Mr. Weir wasn't kicked out of caucus because of what he did. He was supposed to get training. It's because he spoke out publicly about one of his accusers. Mm. Well, Christine Moore has also spoken out, saying she doesn't believe what Mr. Kirkland has said. Why then is there an investigation with her? Mm-hmm. And why doesn't she get subjected to the same discipline or kicked out of caucus as Mr. Weir was?
So let's be really clear. When Aaron Weir had this process happen, there was a discussion between him and the leader. And the discussion was, this is the findings. We found legitimate concerns of sexual harassment and harassment. So the next step is to do the rehabilitation. And that was very clear. That discussion was had. And then, unfortunately, instead of taking that next step, which is doing the rehabilitation, unfortunately, Mr. Weir made a decision to talk about those charges and say that they, or those allegations, and say that they were trumped up. So here we are in a situation where it's really hard to rehabilitate somebody who's not seeing those charges. So right now we're in a place of allowing the process to happen with Ms. Moore, and we'll see what the outcome is of that.
Okay, well, let me bring in Lisa Raitt on that. Again, every situation is different. Mr. Weir claims that he spoke out because one of the victims allegedly gave an interview to a media outlet and he was defending himself. He was fully prepared to go into training. What's your sense of this situation now with Ms. Moore?
Well, I would say this, Evan, that every different circumstance gives us a different outcome, in a sense. And we're all trying to keep up with what's going on. We've had complaints between MPs and staffers. We've had complaints between MPs. We have complaints, or we have concerns about MPs and members of the press. We have complaints about people in bars during an event that's happening around a caucus event. Every single time you have a circumstance like that, we seem to be trying to make up new rules or come up with the response. And I think the parties are doing the best that we can, given the complexity of our role as an MP And really, the fact that there were no rules prior to we started talking about this in 2015 in the House.
Pam Dimoff, when a Canadian veteran appears before a committee and an MP's on that committee, and they end up going back to that MP's room, is that appropriate behavior?
Well, you know what, Evan, I'm not going to comment on the specifics of one specific case, but I think it's very important that all MPs maintain themselves in a way that shows respect to other people, whether it's an employee, whoever it might be. We do have to hold ourselves up to a higher standard, quite frankly. And I think it's important that male victims are confident enough to come forward if that's the circumstance.
Rachel Planey, some have said this is a setback for the Me Too movement, right? Mm-hmm. And some have said, no, this is exactly what it's all about, the Christine Moore situation, now that the accuser has become the accused. Where are you on that?
Well, you know what I think? I think it's really important that we have the fulsome discussion. We know that right now C-65 is something that we're all looking at. And we have to acknowledge that in this place on the Hill, we do not have the regulatory framework that we really need to start addressing these issues. So, you know, for the NDP, we do have some in our collective agreement with staff, but so many staff on the Hill have had nothing for a long time.
One of the issues that Corporal Kirkland brought up is that there was a power imbalance. She's an MP. I was, you know, I'm a veteran. I was a corporal in the military. It was kind of clear to me, you know, she invites me to her office. She gives me gin. That's his allegation. He said, I'm going to go. Is that a power imbalance when they meet at committee? Is that a problem there?
I think that there is a power imbalance for a member of parliament, a witness, because you're actually questioning the witness. So I would say yes. And, you know, we're all going to come up with ways within our own caucuses to deal with this and set out our rules, because we're going to have to do that now that we have different circumstances coming up. And in this case, setting out the rules for caucus that it's inappropriate, in my point of view, to fraternize with witnesses when they have just came off testifying before a committee. I think we'll have to see what the facts are and how the NDP deals with it. But I don't think it's something I'd counsel my caucus members to seek out or to do.
Pam Dimoff, last word on this to you. Will these rules ever get clear, or is it a case-by-case basis?
Well, a lot of it is a case-by-case basis, but I've said before, it's treating other people with respect and recognizing, I mean, you talked about a power imbalance, and there's certainly not just in politics where you're dealing with a power imbalance between, you know, whether it's in a member of parliament and people on the Hill, or whether it's in business, and I think we just need to use some common sense and show some respect to other people. I do think these conversations are important to bring things to light that haven't been discussed before.
Well, we need to talk a lot more about this, and we are again in another situation. I want to thank all of you for joining us today. I really appreciate your insight into a complicated issue. Coming up, warring Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper takes aim at Justin Trudeau's stance on the Iran nuclear deal. Trump takes aim at NAFTA again. The scrum is back to weigh in on that. And we've got our special guest, former interim Conservative leader Ron Ambrose, will join us. Stay right here.
I've never been a NAFTA fan, as you know. NAFTA's been a terrible deal for the United States, one of the worst trade deals in history. We have some bad deals in this country. Between the Iran deal, NAFTA, Mary, we could look at any deal. They're bad deals.
What a stunner. President Donald Trump comparing a trade deal with Canada to the nuclear deal with Iran. Talk about a 1-2 punch. Already, the Iran deal has stirred controversy in Canada, with the former Prime Minister Stephen Harper signing a full-page ad in the New York Times praising Trump's controversial move to pull out of that deal, a position clearly at odds with the current Liberal government. And now, just as optimism was descending over the NAFTA deal, the president has once again signaled that he's, well, ready to drop kick the deal over the fence. What does this all mean? Let's bring in the scrum. They like to sort this kind of thing out. Tawny McCharles is a reporter with the Toronto Star. Joyce Napier, of course, CTV's Ottawa bureau chief. Craig Oliver is CTV's chief political commentator. And our special guest today is the former Conservative leader and current member of the Prime Minister's NAFTA Advisory Council, a Trumpologist maybe, Ronna Ambrose. Great to have everyone here. Iran, I don't know. I mean, if you're on that advisory council, you got to be like a Trumpologist. Can we just start, though, with the former Prime Minister Stephen Harper's assessment of the deal? He likes Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the deal, but he's gone to the trouble to sign a full-page ad in the New York Times. Ron Amherst, is that typical of a former prime minister, and is that his role to do that kind of thing?
This is an issue of global importance, and he's always had a strong view on this deal in particular, and on this issue of Iran's threat in the Middle East in particular. So I think it's perfectly appropriate.
I think it is too, and I also think it is very easy to agree with Harper about his condemnation of the Iranian regime, which is in the habit of murdering innocent Canadians in their prisons, which they've done a number of times now. But where Harper's wrong is to take that and say, and so we should get rid of a leash on the Iranians. We need that leash. We had a leash. And I think it's noticeable that it was only an hour or two after the president announced he was pulling the thing down that the Iranians, for the first time, Iranian troops attacked Israel with rockets because the hardliners are taking over in Iran.
And there's a hard line in Israel as well. Tom,
yeah, no, and I think Ron is right. I mean, Stephen Harper was always hawkish on Israel and hawkish on Iran. And, you know, I think that the government took the right tack initially when they came out and said, you know, he has a right to express his opinion. I wish he would express his opinion on issues like this in Canadian newspapers and to Canadians rather than going to the New York Times and expressing it there. If he wants to back Trump, come here, tell us why and why the policy of the current government of the day is flawed. However, you know, I think he does have a right to his opinion, and I think he's consistent.
I do think he has a right to his opinion, and I do think he should keep it to himself. And, you know, both the Foreign Affairs Minister and the Prime Minister said, well, he's a private citizen now. You do not go ever from being a Prime Minister to just a regular private citizen. You are a former Prime Minister. Therefore, your voice carries a lot more weight than a private citizen. The only person in the government who actually said, yes, this is disruptive, is the Defense Minister, who said, no, this doesn't help us.
What is the Conservative Party here and the Conservative leader's position on this? Harper put them on a spot.
Although, last word on this, Ron Amherst, it's also interesting, under the government that you used to belong to, Canada's embassy in Iran closed, okay? Justin Trudeau said he would think of reopening that embassy. I'm very intrigued now in the wake of rising tension, new sanctions. Does Canada now go ahead and say, we are going to open an embassy in Iran again? And what does that do? Is that provocative to the Trump administration as we're negotiating NAFTA?
Well, I think we have to take our own positions as a sovereign country on this issue. And I happen to agree with Mr. Harper's position to a certain extent, because when we look at the Iran deal and we think of the things that it did not include, which for one thing was to make sure they temper their ballistic missile testing or the building of their ballistic missile program, it also did not include making sure that all of that post-sanctions revenue, economic benefits flowing into Iran actually were supposed to be targeting the rebuilding of the Iranian economy to the benefit of the Iranian people. And that hasn't happened. We've seen massive diversion of money go into propping up people like Assad and Assad's regime and continued state sponsorship of terrorism across the board. So do I think, you know, Trump's handling of this is the perfect way to do it? No, but I do hope that what comes after this is an examination of how accountable Iran has been and how much better we could make a deal like this. So let's hope now Trump engages with Russia, China, Germany, the UK, France, who actually are signatories to this deal, and finds ways to hold them to account.
Why scrap the deal and not say this deal is imperfect, we should amend it, first off? Secondly, the nuclear agency of the UN and the American intelligence community told the president that actually the Iranians are abiding by this particular deal. Now, we want to extend the deal, make it a better deal, then amend it. You scrap it, you have to start from scratch.
Okay, I want to move to NAFTA real quick because there's a couple of things, and I'll start with you, Tonda. Again, Donald Trump saying that, you know, this is such a terrible deal. There's a kind of a May 17th deadline that Congress has got to sign. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. Where are, in your mind now, as we're all trying to read the Trump tea leaves on this, where are we on NAFTA?
I don't think it's possible to get a deal within the time frame that remains.
Right.
And I think it's all going to be pushed beyond the next congressional and Mexican elections.
Joyce?
Same here. I don't think they can do what they want to do. They're so far apart. We get, you know, little tastes in the morning that, oh, they're getting closer, they're getting closer. Listen, they've got so many issues on the table still to settle. Forget about it.
Correct.
There's no reason Congress has to finish this by the 17th. They're saying that to put the pressure on the negotiators. As Alan Gottlieb, the famous negotiator, once said, or ambassador, nothing's over in Washington. The biggest concern now is the end of the month, when the European countries, the NAFTA countries, and China have all been given temporary exemptions. This was the last exemption on the steel and aluminum tariffs. If they put those in place, all of these countries are ready with their own retaliatory taxes. That's what tariffs are. And we could be into a global trade war by sometime in June, which would be really, really dangerous.
Rana, you were optimistic last time you were on the program. Where are you now?
I think it's all up to Mexico now, because this all hinges on the auto part of the of NAFTA. And we know this is around the rules of origin related to wages and labor costs, and we know that those who work in this industry in Mexico get paid $3 an hour, and those in Canada and the United States get paid a lot more. And, you know, Trump is using wages as a pressure tactic to bring Mexico on board, and to, of course, at the end of this, move jobs into the United States and more manufacturing into the United States. So really, everything hinges on whether Mexico can find a path forward on autos. And if they can do that in the next couple of weeks, we might be able to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. But if not, then this is going to be punted down the road past the Mexican election.
Even if Mexico comes on side on increasing their wages in the auto sector, then we're still miles away from a deal. There are questions around dispute resolution. There are questions around a sunset clause on the whole deal. There's questions around the dairy and agriculture sectors in Canada. These are huge issues. This is not going to be NAFTA 2.0. It's going to be a new auto pact.
Yeah, I got to leave it there, because we couldn't solve the NAFTA thing on this one scrum. Amazing. Don't worry. We'll be doing it again. Rana Ambrose, always great to have you on the program. Thanks so much. Coming up, should the government apologize for past wrongs? How important is it? And the battle for Ontario is on. We take on all of that when pollster Nick Danos joins us on the scrum. Stay right here on Question Period. Another apology coming from Justin Trudeau, this time for a horrific act of cruelty when Canada turned away the St. Louis. That was a ship carrying 907 German Jews fleeing the Nazis. The ship was forced to return to Germany. 254 people on board were eventually killed. Canada's policy towards the Jews at the time was known as none is too many. Trudeau has promised to apologize for that, but he's also apologized for other past injustices. So did the former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. He famously apologized for Canada's role in running the residential schools. But when is the right time to say sorry, and what does it mean? Let's bring the scrum back and talk about that. Obviously, Tanya McCharles is back, so is Joyce, so is Craig. And our special guest is Nick Danos, CEO of Danos Research. Nick, great to have you here. Look, it's hard to say these are not the right thing to do. They are. These were genuine, horrific injustices. But they're very divisive. What's the politics of these apologies? Do they resonate well with people?
It's a political two-for-one, because this resonates among millennials and progressives. And for millennials, they like spotlight on things like this. So I think it's good for the Prime Minister in terms of those two groups, because when we get to older people, they think that it might be a little tired.
Right. Well, it's interesting. Pierre Trudeau said he would not apologize for the past. He's interested in fixing the future. His son, Craig, has a very different view.
Yeah, I think his son is apologizing too much. Too many apologies are too many. Some of them seem kind of a little bit like, what was that? Where was that? When was that? However, on the St. Louis, I think it's important for us to remember the degree to which we were a terribly anti-Semitic country in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. You know, it was in the 60s when the quotas against Jews at the University of Toronto, and Jews quotas all over the place, were still in place. That was about the end of that era. Right. And so those of us who still remember that era are glad that people are remembering the degree to which we were a deeply embedded anti-Semitic nation.
But isn't it the point of this apology to remind Canadians about it? I don't think we'd be even talking about it this morning. It's important to remind a country where its policies discriminated against people, just like when Brian Mulroney, way back in the 80s, eventually apologized for the internment of Japanese Canadians in the Second World War. These are terrible periods in Canadian history without constant reminders of which generations wouldn't know about. So I don't agree that too many apologies is too many.
We have had immense ethical progress as a country, that we now look back on these things and say how terrible, how wrong-headed and mean they were.
There's a little bit of hypocrisy or apparent hypocrisy in this. If you want to apologize, do it without the theatrics.
You think there's a sincerity gap?
I think there is a sincerity gap, yes. I think there is a duty perhaps to apologize, but then do it with, you know, a tight upper lip.
All right, the Battle of Ontario. I want to talk about this. This is incredible. The campaign is rolling very quick. The polls have shown that it's Doug Ford, the Progressive Conservative leaders, to lose. Kathleen Wynne, the Liberals, have almost been in power for 15 years. She's polling way behind, and the NDP's had a rush up the middle right now. Nick, what's your read on this and why this particular provincial campaign is important to watch?
Well, it's important because realistically, there are three types of voters. Those that want to smash the Liberals, provincial Liberals, into little bits. Those that want to smash Queen's Park. And those that are afraid of Doug Ford. And this has national implications because it is probably going to be our first and probably most interesting populist election. With populist-style politics, the Ford Nation, we'll see what it is, and I think all the parties are going to focus on Ontario and kind of read entrails.
And watch the NDP leader, who's actually, you know, climbing in the polls, and on Friday's, in Friday's debate, she was being attacked by Doug Ford. So they're starting to see her as a threat, which makes it interesting, makes this race much more interesting than we thought it would be, because it does look like maybe a three-way.
I think in the next few weeks, I'm willing to believe that the NDP will have squeezed the Liberals out in the center and will be the major competition, and we'll have a real hard, polarized right-left fight going on. But Doug Ford's problem still, I think, is that he has not really provided reassurance to this great province of 14 million people, larger than many countries. He provided reassurance that he's really able to run it and understand the issues.
I'm not sure that at the end of the day, that will even matter to many voters. I think many voters are not even looking at his platform, his promises to cut taxes, cut spending, not lose a single public service job, not cut teachers, not cut, you know, all kinds of provincial workers, because really the momentum is behind change, isn't it?
If we see a Ford victory, we're going to also see a federal copycat in terms of the federal conservatives, because they need to do well in Ontario. Yeah. They're going to look at the ridings that he won. They're going to look at how much detail he gave or didn't give, and then they're going to try to replicate that in the next federal election.
Except this year's not Doug Ford, is he?
Well, and that other thing, though, that Joyce talked about, that split, you know, the Doug Ford wins if the left and right split, but if there's a surge with the NDP, and we've seen that federally before, obviously that creates a different dynamic. Can we talk royal wedding? Because it's a big, listen, the whole world's talking about it this week, and by this time Sunday, Harry and Meghan will be the new royal couple. And I just got to ask, because I'm not getting up at four necessarily to watch this thing. But Nick, does the monarchy still resonate as important to Canada's history, or is it basically now just another form of celebrity?
Well, I think in terms of the wedding, it's celebrity for sure, and we shouldn't confuse that with Queen Elizabeth II. That has a significant brand appeal and respect regardless of whether you like the monarchy or not. So it's kind of like, it's like country and western. They've got the celebrity youngins, and then they've got the statesperson, right? Queen Elizabeth as kind of the symbol of the monarchy that people like.
I'm totally guilty of clicking on every Meghan Markle article that pops up.
Finally, you admit it.
On my computer.
Really?
Yes, totally. totally. So
oh, so you're, the, you're
I
done.
I mean, it's the celebrity thing. Yeah, no, I'm all
it's
in.
It's a pretty hot celebrity couple, Joyce. Well, even what's your take on it? Here we go.
No, I mean, listen, I'm sure that
you
a lot of people will
too.
Be. Actually, I don't. But what I find interesting is I think it's two different things. I do think Queen Elizabeth is the most dignified right. public figure. I also think we are in a constitutional prison here in Canada because even if we want to grow up and become, you know, our own country, yeah. we can't. That's where I'm not too keen on the royals. But the wedding, sure,
but
you know.
But isn't the O2 solitudes that this in Quebec, this does not have the same
No, totally play. Not. But I'm sure that in Quebec, a lot of people want it. You know, it's celebrity stuff. Right. It's People magazine. It's entertaining. It's when they're good looking. Like, how can you be against that?
We are, Joyce, our own country, and
no, we are
a monarchy, and it doesn't hold us back. It's a wonderful historical continuity, which is what the royal family means, to me at least. And all of our constitutional processes are built around the monarchy. If we get rid of it, we'll be getting rid of something very important to make that makes us different.
This is going to be.
I disagree with both of them. I don't think we're in a constitutional prison of any kind. We have our own constitution. Right. We pass our own laws.
Then you agree with me too.
And I don't think we have the existential angst over the monarchy.
But our head of state is unelected.
I don't think we do.
Once Queen Elizabeth II passes away, there will be a crisis because people will reevaluate things.
Yeah. Only if we get Charles.
Let's hope so.
I've got to leave it there. This is starting to sound like royal family. We're starting to.
Before we go,
it is Mother's Day, and of course, to the two moms on the panel, Happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
To my mom, my wife, Happy Mother's Day, and to all the moms out there.
All the moms,
enjoy a great Mother's Day. Thanks, Nick Nanos, for joining us. Thanks to the rest of the Scrum. And speaking of the wedding, CTV will have full wedding coverage next Saturday, starting, yes, at 4 a.m. Eastern Time from all of us here at CTV. Thanks for joining us. Happy Mother's Day. We'll be back again in 7 days.